Welcome to the Mind Stogie Mr. Goji podcast with your hosts, Don Gonzalez
and Mark Connolly,
where we get together and discuss everything from the sublime
to the ridiculous.
Welcome back to My Stogie Mr. Goji with your hosts, Don Gonzalez and
Mark Connolly,
with our sidekick,
Yacht Monkey. Oh, wait, Kevin.
All right, so our first segment is what you drinking and what you smoking. Mark?
Okay. I am drinking Dewar's White Label, which I've had before and we've talked about before. It's just sort of my house whiskey, if you will. And I like it. And I'm smoking a La Flor Dominica Ligero. I don't know if that's quite a Maduro.
It looks like a Maduro from
It's here. Maduro-ish. It's actually, considering it's got Ligero in it, it's actually smoking pretty smoothly. This one I've had to trim up the edge a little bit, but it's smoking really good right now. Let's see if I can detect anything. Nope, not a thing. Smoke.
Okay.
Detecting smoke and some tobacco flavor.
All right. Kevin, what are you smoking?
Smoking a Gurkha 125. It's peppery.
All right.
That's all I can tell you about it. It's peppery. Got a nice little spice to it. And then I'm pairing it with a Liquid Death Grim Leafer Tea that uses agave and B vitamins to murder my thirst.
Wow. That's so a pretty aggressive drink.
Though. I didn't realize they made more than just water.
Yeah, they do water, including just what they call mountain water. Then they have the sparkling, carbonated waters. And then they have three different types of tea. So the Grim Leafer and the Berry Slaughter are my favorites.
All right, and Liquid Death comes in a can that looks like a beer can. And if you've ever been on...
Tall boy beer can.
Yeah, if you've been on Instagram, there's actually a story out there about a guy who accidentally packed a beer in his kid's lunch instead of...
Wow.
Supposedly true story. I don't know. You know, it's the internet, so you don't know what to believe.
When you said mountain water, it reminded me of an old skit on the original, like, year two or three of Saturday Night Live, and they had some canned water dredged from the shores of Lake Erie, and they were pouring it into a glass of like molasses with bottle caps and stuff in it. So it was full of minerals. So I don't know what mountain water is, but it's what it reminded me of.
It's the water from the melting caps.
Ah.
Snow caps. I don't know. Sounds nice.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm smoking an Arturo Fuente Hemingway work of art, Natural, which is a Cameroon wrapper with Dominican filler, and I have reviewed this before. And I'm pairing this with what is generally my go-to scotch at home, which is the Glenmorangie, which has a little bit of a citrusy flavor to it, and we've also reviewed this before.
Yeah, and that actually I've gotten a hint of apricot or peach or something out of that before.
Yes, 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 you have. And to be fair, I'm struggling with my cigar tonight. I don't know if it's going to make it to the whole podcast.
That's too bad.
It is too bad. I may have to try to relight it again.
Uh-oh.
All right. We picked up a new segment a couple of weeks ago, and that is, what are you reading?
All right. Right now, I'm pretty intensely reading Gaudium et Spes, because I am doing a presentation on that Saturday.
Have you gotten to paragraph 22?
Probably. What's paragraph 22?
So, the podcast episode from Catholic Stuff that you recommended.
Oh, yes.
Has a reference to another, it's not a podcast, it's a website called Gaudium et Spes 22.
That's right.
And they recommend that author.
Yeah.
And his works. And he does a little bit of podcasting, but mostly writing.
Yeah.
So, and honestly, I haven't gone back to review paragraph 22 to figure out why he chose that paragraph.
Yeah.
But I will say Gaudium et Spes was my favorite document that we studied.
I'm actually breaking it into two parts. It's the longest document, easily the longest document of the Vatican II documents. It's the only constitution that is pastoral in the title.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
And as I've been studying it and researching it, I ran across somebody's description of it as the forgotten Vatican II document. And I think that's an interesting observation, because I think it has been forgotten. So the first part one is basically about the church in the modern world, which is not the first time it's been addressed in the Vatican II documents, but it is addressed a little bit differently in this. And then part two is what I would consider to be the pastoral part. And I think I've said this before, but I like to think of pastoral theology as applied theology. So part two is about specific problems in the world that the church should address. And one of the main points of this document is that the church is for the whole world, even people who are not believers, even people who are atheists. The belief that the church has a lot to say about the different problems in the world. And as you read it, recognizing it was written in the 60s, it's prophetic.
Yes.
So it's a very interesting document. And there is no official English translation, so I'm actually working with two different English versions of this, and they are some of the paragraphs and whatnot, as translated out of the original Latin, have a slightly different focus. So it's interesting to read both. I think it helps give a fuller view of what they're trying to say. So it's a very interesting document.
Yeah, one of the things that I remember drawing from it was how much focus is drawn to the dignity of life and human beings in particular.
Yep.
And how many of the world problems are related to
absolutely
an attack on the dignity of the human.
You could say all of the world problems, I think. I think you can make an argument that all the world problems do revolve around a lack of respect for human dignity. And so it does have something to say to the whole planet.
And when are you giving that talk?
Saturday.
All right. Well, maybe we can talk about that next week.
Okay. We'll do that.
Kevin, what are you reading?
I am finishing up Great Expectations, and I'm doing a deep dive into the first Dune book in preparation for part two.
Right. Now the movie. Yes.
So I have just barely started reading a new book called Courting the Saints. And it's a book from 10 publishers, and I can't remember the number of saints that they review, but they talk about how they courted and found their spouses. So this is part of the Book of the Month club, if you will, from the San Jose Maria Institute for recommended reading. And I've tried to do this every month. I've been like 75% successful in completing the books each month, but I think it's fitting that they chose this book for February, since Valentine's Day is around the corner. So I like it. I mean, I think for me, it was interesting because I've started helping with RCIA at my parish, and the first lesson that we gave on was on the sacrament of matrimony and some of the questions that came out of that. Actually, I wish I had read this book beforehand, but the focus is on the idea that marriage is a vocation. So I know that one of the stories is about Mary's marriage to the Holy Spirit and to Joseph.
Yeah.
And then one of them, which I'm looking forward to, is a story about Pope Benedict learning about how his parents met. And that's in there.
Oh, really?
So I think that's going to be cool.
That'll be interesting.
All right. So our main topic of conversation tonight is going to be Catholic morality. I'm actually, in a couple of days, going to be the lead teacher for Catholic morality for our RCIA group. So, let's see how this goes. It's been a while since we took our moral theology course with
Yeah.
Professor Wynn. But I guess we could start off with some definitions. You're the definition king. You want to start off with a definition of morality?
Well, in Catholic terms, morality flows from the fact that we are created by God and that there is a human dignity to bring that up again. And so this is the response to how should we, fundamentally, how should we act towards each other? And what is the right way to act and versus the wrong way? And it's essentially rooted in love, frankly. But as different circumstances come up in life, there's a lot of different ways to look at things. And sometimes it's not really clear what's the right thing to do. You know, I think one of the questions that I've heard before is, for an example, lying. Is lying always wrong? And one of the questions that came up is, you know, if the Nazis are knocking at your door, wondering if you've got Jews hidden in your house, is it okay to lie about it? So those kinds of questions come up, but let's face it, those aren't the kinds of questions we run into day to day. We don't have that kind of dilemma presented to us. Instead, we get dilemmas like, what do we do with our taxes? You know, what about speeding? You know, is it okay to run a stop sign? You know, if you're hearing gossip, do you spread it? You know, it's all, how do we interact with each other? And what are the guidelines that we can find from the Catholic Church for that? So morality is just right behavior.
Okay. So I want to maybe back up a little bit and give maybe an even more general definition of morality is a means for judging what is good and what is evil.
Okay.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
And so in a Catholic context, I think that, you know, if you look in the catechism, there's a whole section dedicated to morality. I think that's actually what it's called. I can't remember off the top of my head. But it's broken into two parts. It's the Ten Commandments and the Beatitudes.
Right.
So the kind of the negative reinforcement with the Ten Commandments and the positive enforcement with the Beatitudes.
Right.
And I think that it may be Thomas Aquinas who said the aim of the Christian is to do good and avoid evil.
Correct.
And so I think that's what you're talking about. So I think maybe we talk a little bit about morality in a general sense and also in the context of mortal and venial sin and what makes that up.
Right.
And then maybe we can talk about some real life issues. Because I think that's probably the application, to go back to the pastoral,
right,
of the morality, I think is probably what most people are interested in. Because I think a lot of times, new Catholics, old Catholics, when they first learn about the catechism, they start looking at it as moral code book. Like they're going to find a list of do's and do nots. And
right,
that's just not the way it is. Which actually is another thing that we should probably talk about is how to form a good conscience, formed and informed.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because one of the ideas out there is that you should follow your conscience. And a lot of people have taken that as, oh, I get to decide what I think is good or bad. And this fits my conscience. And it's remarkably flexible depending on what you want to do. So...
Well, and that's prevalent in our society today, and that's called moral relativism.
Yeah, and to give sort of a real world and maybe not so absurd example, it's like, it's probably not a good idea to go to a topless bar, but my friend's getting married and it's his bachelor party and I want to be there to support him, so, you know, it's the right thing to do. It's to go to this topless bar for the bachelor party because, you know, it's all relative anyway, and I'm not there to pick up anybody. I'm just supporting my friend. So, you
know. Okay.
Well, I mean, you know, there's
kind of. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess there are other ways that people play games with the moral relativism, you know, and honestly, I think that where we really encounter this most is with non-Christian No, really, actually, non-Christian is a bad word. I mean, there are Christians, I think, that have bought into the. You've got the new catechism over there in the.
Yeah, but what I'm looking for is this book right here, the Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church. It's the social doctrine has a lot to say about morality. I bring it up because there's not an official Catholic book on social doctrine, but this is the closest thing we have. And one of the interesting things for us is that it was largely written by a relative of Professor Wynne. It references him in the foreword. It's actually from the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, and it was finalized by somebody else after the. I think he was a bishop after he passed away, but it was interesting to have that sort of ancillary contact with the person who wrote most of it, being the relative of our Professor Wynne. Just want to shout that out there.
Okay.
It's called the Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church.
And I bet very few people have read that. And to be clear, a lot of people hear social justice or social doctrine and immediately think of social justice warriors and that sort of thing. And I think that one of the concepts in Catholic theology and morality that I heard early on that I used to think was kind of just a throwaway phrase, actually legitimate, is both and, that you have to have both mercy and justice. And it's not an either or when we start talking about things like Catholic social doctrine. It's about both, So we might get an opportunity to talk about that, especially in light of us listening to that podcast episode from Catholic Stuff, which I'll link in the show notes, that had a discussion about this battle. I'm going to call it a battle, particularly in the American Catholic sphere of the, or what I would call the two extreme sides of Catholicism in this country, the progressive, led by people like Father James Martin. And then the rad trads led by people like Taylor Marshall, and how that's pulling people away. And at the end of the day, we're called to be Catholic.
Yeah, there's a false definition taking place there.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What I'm reminded of is that scripture when Paul is talking, and I can't remember which one of his epistles this is, but he's saying, you don't follow Apollo, you don't follow Paul, you follow Christ. And, part of that is discerning what is truth, having that form conscience so that you know what is right and what is wrong. And not being swayed by, it's really kind of been like the politics of, or the politicization, if that's a word, of the church. And a lot of this has happened during the pontificate of Pope Francis, let's be honest about that. And it can be messy at times, and I'm really struggling with this a little bit too in talking to these newbies that are coming into the faith. I think we have to be straightforward with them, and I'm wrestling on how to do that. To be honest with them and say, look, this is for us, at you and I are like, I'm near 60, you're in your 60s. We basically lived through some very good popes. And I'm not saying Francis is a bad pope. I'm just saying his leadership style is different. Some people say it's very Jesuit, it's very messy, it can be confusing. And honestly, I think it's a difficult time, challenging time for somebody who's coming into the church. And I would say that's very courageous as well for somebody to be called to come to the church in this time. But another topic for another day. I think one of the things that we should talk about now before we go any further is to kind of frame some of this in the context of what is sin, what is grave sin, what is venial sin. Do we have a good definition for sin?
Well, I mean, the simple definition, I guess, is not doing God's will. The problem with that definition is how do you determine what God's will is? So that's part of the whole, topic here. I read an interesting definition that said sin is failure to live your freedom well, which probably requires some teasing out, but I like that definition because it implies a lot of different things. One is that we are free. We have free will. We can make our own decisions, but do we do it well? And, with that idea of do good and avoid evil, not avoiding evil would be a sin. Doing things that harm others is a sin. But it's basically my will be done versus thy will be done. And unfortunately, a lot of people see my will be done as an exercise of their free will when it's not. It's a caving in to I guess our wounded nature and just wanting to find. We have a confusion about happiness and joy. The idea that we should be happy all the time is perverted into, pleasure versus joy. And pleasure is transitory, it comes and goes. Joy, a true joy is doesn't come and go. It's always an underlying reality in your psychological makeup. But it doesn't have the highs and lows that, pleasure does. And so a lot of people will seek pleasure, and because of the nature of being a human being and having a human body, pleasure tends to be material and manifests as, sexual sin, gluttony, whatever you want to point out that's a an excess pursuit of what makes us feel good.
So while you're saying that, I was thinking, isn't true happiness as an end communion with God?
Yes. Yeah. And I guess one of the hard parts about that is while we're alive, we're not going to be in full communion with God. It's just not in the cards, so to speak.
Which goes to the quote of Saint Augustine that our hearts are restless until they rest in Him.
Yep.
Right, so the church teaches that there are two types of sin, mortal sin and venial sin. And mortal sin is called mortal sin because it breaks your relationship with, separates you from God.
Yep.
And there are some requirements for a sin to be mortal. So the sin has to be of grave nature. You ever do an examination of conscience? There are all sorts of booklets on this for reconciliation. They normally use the Ten Commandments as a framework for that. I think that's a good guide.
Right.
And I correct me if you think I'm wrong with this, but I think most sins can be categorized into two categories: sins against God, sins against fellow man.
Yep.
So it has to be a grave matter. So for the sake of conversation, let's just say a violation of one of the Ten Commandments. You have to know that it's a grave matter,
Right.
and that you knowingly and willingly commit that sin.
Yeah, you do it anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that makes it a mortal sin,
Yeah,
which.
and the term mortal, that it comes from, like in Spanish, the word muerte,
Yes.
death. And I remember having a conversation with my friend Steve, and I had made the comment at one point about mortal sins and venial sins. And at first he thought that was ridiculous because it's all sin against God. But then he did some Bible reading and he came back and he said, I don't know what to think about this because the Bible specifically says that there are deadly sins, and it differentiates between sins and deadly sins. So he had to recognize that there's some categorization going on that is biblical, and mortal means deadly, and it means it essentially kills our relationship with God versus venial sins.
Yeah, and to be clear, If you commit a mortal sin, you're required to go to reconciliation.
Right.
That is the normal way that we receive absolution.
Right.
And regain our relationship or reconcile
right.
the relationship with God. So, yeah. So that's that for Catholics. And so that's, I would say that's the easy way.
Right.
To reconcile. Because people always bring up, you know, well, like, can't you pray to God and be forgiven? God's not bound by the sacraments. He lives outside right. of the sacraments. But we are.
Yeah.
And that's the normal, ordinary way for Catholics to reconcile with God. And then there are venial sins. These are lesser sins that don't necessarily break the bond with God. Be like white lies, things of that sort. While they may not separate you from God, they may build up. I remember hearing Father Carapi once say that venial sins can clog up the soul to the reception of grace. And, you know, he called reconciliation like the Roto-Rooter of your soul.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you and also if you fall into a pattern of venial sin, I think that makes you more susceptible. A mortal sin?
Yeah, I think there's a habituality to a venial sin that can let you fall into mortal sin. And I think one of the problems in our society today is just the loss of the idea of sin or the concept of sin, that it's a thing. And the venial sins are those sins that are, you know, weaknesses that we indulge in that sooner or later, I think almost inevitably, if they're not dealt with, will lead to mortal sin. And so when you go to confession, it's not a bad idea to confess your venial sins as well, even though it's not necessary. Because if I understand correctly, venial sins can be basically dealt with in the Mass.
Yes.
When we do the act of contrition. Or the, what is the
Confiator.
Yep. Oh my God, I'm heartily sorry for having offended thee. No, that's actually in confession.
The mea culpa, mea culpa.
Yep.
Latin.
Right.
But not Latin. The
right.
normal Mass.
Yeah.
So the last thing I think that we need to talk about before we start talking about scenarios is the idea of a formed and informed conscience. The idea formed is that we have a responsibility to know our faith so that we can live our faith.
Right.
That means, like, what is it called when you can't lean on willful ignorance?
No.
You know, we're responsible for knowing our faith and knowing what's right and what's wrong. And as it is taught by Holy Mother Church, as Catholics, that's what we believe. She's our teacher, normally through the priests and bishops. And we have documents to support this. I would say the catechism is a good starting point for learning about that.
Yep.
And I know in my own personal walk early on and coming back to the church, I tried to avoid certain topics because I did not want to know, you know, what was right or wrong.
Yeah, but willful ignorance is not invincible ignorance.
Yeah, so That's not gonna get you. That's not a get out of jail free card.
No.
So you know, God gives us a brain. He gives us intellect. We should know how to use it, and we should practice that, and
yep.
then we should live that out.
And the idea of being formed, you know, people. It's funny that people will react to that with a negative idea, as if we aren't trained in everything we ever learn how to do. You know, we had to be formed to walk properly. You know, you start walking around start crawling around on the floor and you see grown-ups and people older than you walking. So you begin to model that behavior. You know, everything that we do, we get better at through practice and through instruction. I mean, it's just natural. And so the idea that our consciences need forming shouldn't seem so alien to people. Of course they need forming. Just like we need to learn how to speak, we need to learn how to walk, we need to learn how to do math, you know, all of these things. people teach us. Competent teachers, if you're lucky, teach you all these things that you need to know. And so the church is a competent teacher in you know, how we should live well. We shouldn't reject that. We should recognize that it's actually beneficial to our long-term well-being and our happiness.
What I want to say about that is that kind of goes back to the talk that we had about formation. We have a responsibility for our own formation and being informed, of informing ourselves. And we have way more resources available to us now than ever before at our fingertips.
Yep.
And if we don't know where to look, then find somebody that you trust who's living out a good, somebody that you know has got a good prayer life and is living the sacramental life, and ask them questions and like what to read and
right.
whatnot, other sources beyond the catechism. But I would say the catechism is a good start, and read through it. But what I want to say about that, and I think I alluded to it already, that catechism is not a list of do's and do nots. It's really about informing you generally what, you know, I think generally it forms your conscience and what's right and what's wrong. For example, in the chapters in the catechism as it relates to the sanctity of life, you're not going to find any mention in there whatsoever about human cloning.
No.
But it informs our decisions about things like human cloning.
Right. Yeah, it's catechism, which comes from the word catechize, which means to teach. So it is a teaching aid. And it's very accessible to anybody who has a high school level of reading, and is certainly worth working through. It's divided up into four pieces that are logically put together and logically build on each other. It's not a list of rules and regulations any more than a math book is. It's this is how you do math. Well, this is how you live a good life. This is how you, you know, follow the teachings of the church. These are the teachings of the church. And it should be viewed as a really helpful aid and not some sort of a rule book, because it's not what it is. It will help you understand whatever rules may be out there. In all aspects, I mean, you can read the catechism and then think through civil law and go, well, yeah, that aligns with the catechism, or, well, that doesn't, like abortion being legal, for an example, didn't really align with the catechism. But, you know, not stealing, I mean, that's both a commandment and it's also a civil law. So these things aren't as separated as people would have you believe. They're very intertwined, actually.
So do you think now's a good time to talk about maybe some scenarios?
Yeah. I know you, I think you're working on some, right?
Yeah, I am working on some, and I don't know how suitable these are for the audience that I'm going to have on Thursday, but I'm leaning towards doing something like this. You know, I think that, you know, a lot of the issues that are facing American Catholics have to do with sexual moral ethics. And, you know, one of those that stands out is abortion.
Yeah.
So the idea I had was to create a scenario about a young couple faced with an unplanned pregnancy. And the young man in the scenario is a formed and informed Catholic. Mm-hmm. And in a moment of weakness, has sex with his girlfriend, gets her pregnant, and they both decide to get an abortion. So that's scenario number one. He takes her to the clinic to get an abortion. Is that a sin?
Yes.
And it's a grave sin, because remember the scenario says he's formed and informed. He mm-hmm. knows that abortion is a grave sin.
Right.
And no one's putting a gun to his head. He willingly participates. He doesn't do the abortion, but he takes the girl to the clinic to get the abortion. Yeah, he cooperates. Thank you. Good word. So that's scenario number one. Pretty black and white, I think.
Yeah.
The next scenario is the same sort of setting, but in this case, the young man is not necessarily the person. I actually don't really think it matters if he's the father or not, the more I think about it.
Okay.
It
muddies the water if he's not.
Yeah, but let's play this out and see how it plays out. We're doing this live, so we'll just see how it works out. Because this is not the original scenario I shared with you the other night. So, father of the child, catechized, knows what's right and what's wrong, and tells the girl, I don't agree with your decision to have an abortion, but I'm going to take you to have the abortion. Is that sinful?
Well, I don't know how it's not.
I think it still is, especially if in this conversation he's like, not my choice, it's your choice. I will take you.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's still cooperating in the action.
Yeah.
And so therefore he's still culpable.
Yeah, but it's a good, I think it's a good example though, because maybe he feels very strongly against it, but he's torn. Loves his wife or his girlfriend, whatever it may be. Doesn't want her to deal with it by herself. Doesn't want to drive a further wedge between him and his significant other, if you will. You know, there's a lot of different layers that could be there. He could be saying, well, I disagree, but secretly he's kind of glad.
Yeah.
So he's saying the right things, but internally he's really okay with it. So that's, if that's the case, then that's a sin. He can't kid himself or God that he doesn't know exactly what he's doing.
Yeah.
Or he could be really torn.
Right. And I'm going to get to that scenario in a second, but I think the point you're making is you can't play lawyer ball with God.
No.
To borrow a line from King of the Hill.
Yeah.
So the next scenario is even more complicated and I think is very real world. So let's continue the story with the guy being the father. And he's adamant with the young lady that, look, this is wrong. We shouldn't do it. I'm opposed to this. We know this is wrong. But out of an act of charity and wanting to maintain a connection with the young woman to be able to bring her back or to be there in a loving way, he says, I don't support what you're doing. And in a very charitable way, says the act, I can judge the act as being objectively wrong. I'm not judging you. I love you. I will be there for you because this is going to be hard on you. I will be there for you, but I'm not supporting what you're doing. I think there may be a place where that's not sinful.
You know, there are some factors I think to be considered there. One is she going to do it anyway? You know, if he's there or not there. And let's say he's completely uninvolved in the pregnancy. He's just a friend of this person. And she's come to him and says, my family, blah, 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 my boyfriend, blah, 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 whatever, but I can't do this. And I don't have anybody else. And he's like, you know, torn. Okay. He knows somewhere inside of him that, and this is just a reality, there's long-term effect on a woman who has an abortion. Nobody likes to talk about it, but it's real. And it may not manifest for years. I remember having a conversation with somebody who even at the same time saying she supported abortion, said that, you know, she's had one, and she goes, it makes you feel cold inside. It makes you feel it's a horrible thing to have done. And yet she couldn't say it should be wrong, it should be illegal or anything like that. But she was basically saying, and it's because of the cultural pressure that says it's a woman's right to choose. At some level, you buy into that lie because it's a lie. And so because it's so enculturated, you're like, but it is my right to choose. And she did it. And she was long-term impacted by that decision and knew it. She couldn't still quite bring herself to say it should be illegal, but she was, it kind of messed her up.
Yeah.
And so if you've got a guy who's going, she's going to do this anyway, and then she's going to be alone, she's going to need somebody. You know, the hard part for me is still loading her in the car and carrying her down there. And that's the part that I'm struggling with.
Right.
And I don't know the short answer to that.
I don't either. So, I mean, obviously you can change the scenario and say he meets her there or he's in the parking lot and waits for her and greets her as she comes out of the clinic.
Yeah.
And I think that probably gets you closer to a point where it's more clear.
You know, maybe it's she calls him from the clinic and says, I need a ride home. Well, that's different, I think, if there's no knowledge going in. Or maybe you knew, but you didn't know then. I mean, maybe you knew she was considering it, or maybe she even told you she was going to do it. And he's like, yeah, I'm really sorry you feel like you have to make that decision. I can't really support that. You know, call me if you need me kind of thing. And then he gets a call and, well, yeah, he's going to go pick her up from the clinic and bring her home. I don't think there's anything sinful about that.
Yeah.
A third scenario I want to throw in there is, what about the guy who's not formed and then years later figures out that he may have cooperated in evil? Because I know somebody that did that. It's just a friend. He's not formed, not Catholic, not anything. Drove her to the clinic, took her home. Years later becomes Catholic and is like, oh my God. And he's confessed it and he still feels bad.
Well, I mean, I think there are two things at play there. Number one, someone needs to teach him about what absolution really means.
Yeah.
Number one. And number two, I'm not even sure he ever committed a grave sin because he wasn't aware.
Right. Because there is the reality that our society basically has beat the drum that it's a woman's right to choose. It's a woman's right to choose. It's not a person. I mean, the original lie being told is it's just a blob of tissue. You know, I remember when I was 17 working at McDonald's, when the Supreme Court passed that, you know,
Roe v. Wade.
Yeah. And this girl goes, yay, they passed Roe v. Wade. And I go, what's that? She goes, women can have an abortion. And I went, why would you want to kill your baby? I mean, I'm just 17, right? I'm like, why would you want to kill your baby? And she turned, she spun on me. She goes, it's not a baby. It's a blob of tissue. And I was like, what? How is it not a baby? But her anger shocked me. But that's what the message was.
Right.
It's just a blob of tissue. And it's an out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. And so if you're not raised with, if you're not catechized at all, if you're not raised with any kind of, you know, you're buying into that. You're being told it's a woman's right to choose. It's not really a human being. It's not a person. Everybody's doing it, you know. There's still a piece of me that thinks, come on, you kind of know you shouldn't kill your babies. But if people really believe it's not a baby, if they think it's just a blob of tissue, it's hard to say that they're culpable, I think. They're being told repeatedly, they're being catechized, if you will, that abortion's a positive good.
But are they even making that argument anymore? Because no. In 72, the science was more lacking.
Yeah. They're not making that argument now, no.
No. So I didn't share this with you the other night, but this scenario actually came out from a real-life experience for me as a teacher. This was many years ago. I had a former student of mine who was still very much a student of mine and called me in the middle of the night. It wasn't late night. It was like 8:30 or 9, calling me that she thought she was pregnant. She was driving to a clinic, she thought. And I had a decent relationship with this kid. I mean, obviously she had my phone number, so she had, you know, I was her debate coach. And I talked to her on the phone. I'm like, don't do anything stupid. You have other options. But she was adamant she was going to go do this. She was dating. She was like 17. Her boyfriend was like 22. Parents were just, they had abdicated their responsibilities. Like, they knew this guy was taking her to and from school and her after school activities. So they didn't care that this was really an inappropriate relationship.
Right.
And I remember telling her, I was like, don't do anything stupid. You have other options. And she was adamant she was still going to go. And I remember telling her, like, look, I can't stop you from doing this. It's wrong. I'm telling you this is wrong. But I'm not going to abandon you. I'm going to be here for you no matter what.
Right.
I didn't have to face any, you know, like the scenario we're talking about, because what's funny about this story is she thought she was going to abortion clinic. She went to a crisis clinic that was run by Christians.
Okay.
And so the first question they asked was about the boyfriend and how old he was. So they called the police.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, grace of God, turns out she wasn't pregnant. So there was no abortion. But the sad part about it is that, you know, here in the state of Texas, like, there are issues about consent. I can't remember. She may have been 16. To think is below the age of consent, especially when there's that huge, 6 years is a pretty big gap.
At that age, it certainly is.
And the parents refused to press charges against the guy. And that just tells you something about the parents.
Yeah.
But it's that story that kind of got me thinking about this scenario.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that, you know, when we're in RCIA classes or when we're having these type of formation questions, we always talk in the theoretical. But I don't think that we get our hands dirty and talk about this, because life is complicated. Life is messy.
Yeah.
And I think that when you're talking to people about their faith, we need to be talking about issues like this, because this is where, you know, this, where the stuff hits the fan, and you have to know the way that you're supposed to respond to it.
Yeah.
And if people aren't properly prepared for that, they're not going to respond the right way, I guess is what I'm saying. And so that's part of the reason why I pose that question. This type of scenario appropriate for a bunch of people who are just barely contemplating coming into the church, you know, like.
Well, you know, there may be people that are going to disagree with what I'm about to say, but the answers aren't always easy, and they're not always the answers they want to hear. And if they're going to actually be Catholics, they need to understand what that means. And then the problem, I think, is going from that of the church says no to here's why the church says no and why it's the right answer and why you really want to live this way versus, oh, well, you know, you can, you know, God's merciful and it's all good. And Because the reality of it is, all moral theology aside, or whatever you want to call it, there are psychological consequences to doing things that are harmful to yourself and to others. And that's one of the things the church recognizes. That's part of why we have, you know, these prohibitions against doing these kinds of things. They're fundamentally harmful to you as a person. And it's not even debatable. There's long-term repercussions. I knew a guy when I was at McDonald's. He was an assistant manager, and he got a Catholic girl pregnant, and they went and got an abortion, and they got married, and then they got divorced because the relationship was broken. Even though they thought they'd fixed it, it was broken, fundamentally broken. And that's real, and that's why the church teaches what it teaches, because the end result, the desired goal, is people who are not broken. And sometimes the answer is no, you can't do that, and it's a hard answer, and people don't want to hear it, but they need to hear it. Just like you don't let your kid just sit and eat all the Halloween candy the night they bring it home. The answer is no. It's bad for you. So sin is bad for you. As a human, materially, you know, physically, but also emotionally, and also spiritually. It's bad. It's a trifecta.
Yeah.
And so when the church is teaching this is a sin, you should be going, well, that's a warning label. This is a bottle that has poison written on it, and I probably shouldn't drink it. And thank the church for letting me know to recognize the poison label, because that's what sin is.
Well, I want to go back to my true story.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's an epilogue to it. I didn't realize it at the time, but I think what I took was a pastoral approach.
Yeah.
I told the girl what was right and what was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It is indeed still her free choice to commit. You know, and she wasn't Catholic. To follow through. In this case, she didn't. But I made it very clear that even though she might make a wrong decision, I was still going to be there for her.
Yeah.
Fast forward 4 or 5 years after that, she gets married to a different guy.
Mm-hmm.
She eventually has 2 children
mm-hmm.
out of that marriage, and she's still married to this guy. And she asked me to be the godfather to both of those children.
Wow.
So I think that there were some positive fruits.
Yeah.
Because I kept, and this is kind of the point of the scenario building, is we have to look, I think in the pastoral world, we have to find ways to be able to preach the truth, but with charity,
mm-hmm.
and keep the door open for a relationship. Because I know people like this that could have condemned her in that moment and say, what you're doing is wrong. I cannot condone it, with a tone that would have been like, I'm done with you.
Right.
And that severs the relationship.
Yep.
And I think we're called to do more than that.
Yes, I agree.
And that's not easy.
No.
And that's not, well, it's messy. It can be messy and complicated.
Yep.
But that's life. Life is messy and complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And living out your faith can be messy and complicated.
Yeah.
And that's the world we live in.
Well, and these people that are becoming Catholics, you know, let's say they go through with it and they become Catholics, they're going to sin. You know, and they need to recognize that when they sin, God still loves them.
Right.
And that the church has put processes and systems and remedies in place, the sacraments, to deal with the fact that we're going to fall. And that's a blessing. And, you know, they don't need to think, well, it's okay if I sin, because it's not. They just need to recognize you're going to. You know, it's, if being a saint were easy, then everybody would do it.
Yeah.
So again, from a psychological standpoint, from an understanding of the human person, and this is really rooted in the incarnation, you know, Jesus became a man, a human being. The church has a deep understanding of what it means to be a human being and what our potential is and what our potential for failing is. And there's remedies that are available. And you've got to, we need to be able to let people know that, and we need to be able to let them forgive themselves and have someone they can talk to that is going to tell them, yeah, that's a sin, but I'll still be there for you, just like you did with that girl. I think that's a real world example of the right way to be. So I applaud you on that. Because it would have been real easy to go, well, you know, if you do this, then don't even come back to my class or whatever. I'm not going to put you on my mock trial team or whatever.
Right.
And that would have been exactly wrong.
But I think we can fall into that trap.
Oh, absolutely. There's a triumphalism that's real easy to fall into. You know, I'm holy and you're not, and you need to do what I say, and if you're not doing what I'm saying, then what are you even asking me the question for? And
yeah,
blah, blah, blah. And it's,
well, what I go back to is that we can objectively judge the act,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know that we can objectively judge. Well, I know the answer to this. You can't objectively judge the heart of a person.
No.
You can't judge the person.
No.
But you can love the person.
Yep.
And isn't that what Jesus did?
Yeah. Yeah.
But he did say, you know, to be clear, I'm reminded of that line. It's like, because it's, Pope Francis has often misquoted on this, like, who am I to judge? Yeah, Jesus said that, but he also said, go and sin no more.
Yeah.
Do what's right.
Yeah. Do good, avoid evil.
Yeah. And when you mess up and fall, if you're Catholic, go to reconciliation.
Yeah.
All right. That's a good place to.
All right.
So, my cigar failed me. I struggled all the way throughout and it died early. May have been because it was poorly lit to begin with, maybe poorly cut. I don't know. But it did not last the whole podcast.
Well,
how was your cigar? Did it last pretty good?
It lasted until I got started into the third, and then I was having relight problems and it just wouldn't stay lit. The first two thirds were fine. I would have liked to have smoked it another half inch or so, but I gave up.
Same here. Kevin, did your cigar do well for you?
Yes. Yeah, I smoked it down to the last inch or so before it went out.
And I actually finished my scotch, my two fingers of scotch, which is rare. I usually don't.
Yeah, I'm almost finished with my two fingers of scotch.
Yeah. Your fingers are a little bigger than mine.
Wow, he just body shamed me on air, said I have fat fingers.
No, you have manly fingers. I have delicate pianist hands.
That was a very pastoral response. So before we conclude, one of the things that we're going to attempt to do is add a fourth segment.
Yeah.
And a brief segment.
Yeah.
And we're going to call it Doubts, Answers, and Non Sequiturs.
Right.
An acronym that stands for, well, the acronym is DAN.
Yes.
We have a friend, Dan, who we get together with to to smoke cigars from time to time, and from time to time he sends us Facebook Messenger messages posing questions about Catholicism and the faith in general that I think are good questions that people ask. So we're going to treat that as like kind of our Q&A until we get Q&A from our massive audience.
Right.
But in honor of Dan, we're going to have a segment called Doubts, Answers, and Non Sequiturs. And for now, we're going to draw from questions that Dan has asked us in the past.
Yep.
Because I think they're good questions that need to be answered, and we'll answer those hopefully in like a 5 to 10 minute span, and then we'll get to whatever our main topic is. And I think we're going to talk about God Emits Best next week.
All right.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, and smoke them if you got them.
All right. Good night.
There's a regular Three Stooges here.